Willkommen bei We Like Max, dem Podcast über die Publishing-Branche und ihre Macherinnen und Macher. Mein Name ist Christian Kallenberg und diese Episode entsteht in Zusammenarbeit mit FIP, gegründet als Federation of the International Periodical Press und heute das globale Netzwerk für Medienunternehmen. Und wie Sie vielleicht in einer der letzten Folgen schon gehört haben, veranstaltet die FIP dieses Jahr im Juni in Cascais in Portugal den FIP Congress. Vom 7. bis zum 9. Juni treffen sich Expertinnen aus der Publishing-Branche weltweit zum Networken und zum Erfahrungsaustausch. Und heute bei mir zu Gast ist James Hughes, der Präsident und CEO der FIP. Und ich darf Ihnen verraten, es ist eine Premiere hier, denn wir unterhalten uns auf Englisch. Los geht's! Hello, James.
Hello, Christian. Hi.
Very good to have you on the show. As you know, it's a premiere here. It's our first English language episode, and I can't think of any better guest than you, James. But before we continue in English, just to make sure, how about your German skills?
Nein, Christian, ich kann nicht Deutschsprache.
But I like your pronunciation. Great.
Well, when I was a child, I lived in Switzerland. So if you'd asked me when I was 7, I probably could do it in German, but then I wouldn't have anything interesting to tell you.
But did you have a Switzerdeutsch accent then?
I had Switzerdeutsch, yeah. So I can still, when I go to Switzerland and sit on the tram in Basel, I can understand the tram driver. It's quite an achievement, I think.
But also, can you buy your own ticket speaking Switzerdeutsch or not?
Yeah, more or less. Sometimes. Depends. I have to practice a little bit first.
Wow, James. Hidden skills I didn't know about.
Yeah, absolutely. See? Not just a pretty face, although you can't see my face, but not just a pretty face.
But I will be able to see your pretty face again soon in June in Cascais. Is that the way you pronounce it as well?
Absolutely. Good pronunciation. Yes, I was there last week. We're looking forward to our Congress, which happens June the 7th to the 9th in Cascais, which is just outside Lisbon in Portugal. Should be a great event, the first in-person Congress since 2019. And I'm looking forward to seeing you there as well. It should be a great event.
What better than summer in Portugal, in Lisbon even, which I think is one of the most beautiful cities in Europe. And of course, the fantastic program that you're putting together for the Congress and seeing everybody in person again. I'm really looking forward to this. But before we talk about the Congress, about the event itself, let's talk a little bit about FIP, the organization, the association that you are president and CEO of. It's quite an old one, isn't it?
Absolutely. We're not, it's so old that we're not entirely sure how old it is. We think it's about 1919. We know that our first Congress was in 1926. So we date certainly from before the 1930s, probably before the 1920s even. We existed then as an organization for French and Spanish publishers to network with one another. And that kind of networking mission has been at the core of what we do ever since, over the last 100 years. We're not a traditional trade association in that we don't do any government lobbying or policy work or any of that kind of stuff. We really are here to help our members do business. And that might be in the form of sharing knowledge with one another, or it might be in the form of meeting one another so that they can do deals or learn from each other, or meeting people who are in our space. And increasingly, that's the exciting startup and tech world who have so much to bring to the publishing industry.
I was just about to ask, who are your members? Is it mainly legacy publishers, or are there different kind of companies as well?
Yeah, membership is now quite broad, I have to say. I mean, beyond the core of our media owner membership, which still consists of companies like Condé Nast and Hearst and Burda, magazine companies, let's say magazine media companies, as we prefer to call them these days, there is also now a growing base of publishers who didn't start in magazines. So that might be a traditional newspaper publisher like the New York Times, might be a television business like the BBC, or it might even be a non-traditional media business entirely like Red Bull. So Red Bull's big media operation is a member of FIP. And then, of course, there's a big base of members who are tech businesses. These are companies who are building software as a service platforms to help us as publishers do our business better, to improve our business. And they might be in fields such as CMS or digital subscription platforms and payment platforms. And really, the interesting thing about those guys is that they increasingly bring a wealth of their own knowledge from their own experience of implementing these SaaS solutions to the membership. So it's long gone are the days where they're suppliers. They are actually tech partners now and able to teach us something. And then there is still a large base of associations around the world, people and companies who help publishers to do business better, and they might be focused on a local market or on a particular thematic topic internationally. And we have a big base of members among them. So yes, it is very broad.
You haven't been on board ever since, obviously. I think you took over as CEO in 2017. I'm sure you knew FIP before that date. So what are your earliest memories of FIP?
That's a good question. So I ran the international business for the magazine division at the BBC for many years. And really, my first interaction with FIP was when we were establishing that international business in the early 2000s. And I was looking around for a way to help me connect with publishers and potential partners across the world. And I came across, I think the first FIP event I came across was then WMM, World Media Marketplace. It was really a content and brands marketplace event that happened every year in London in those days. And I was interacting with FIP through that. And over time, I started to go to the FIP Congress and to other FIP events and to interact more with the organization. Then when I moved to the Middle East in 2013, Chris Llewellyn, who was my predecessor as CEO of FIP, asked me to sit on the FIP board to represent that region, which, of course, I was very happy to do. And then that kind of led in 2017 to me being appointed as CEO. So I've had a very long association with FIP. I'm a very firm believer in the association's benefit to the industry. And it's really great, you know, to be able to pay some of that back, to pay back some of the help that FIP gave me in building my business, and to give something back to the organization and help it grow in turn.
Absolutely. I think my earliest memory is the WMM, the World Magazine Marketplace 2009 in, I think it was in Dubai. But that event kind of merged with the Congress by now, didn't it?
That's right, because I think the nature of the way that we do business as an industry has changed dramatically. I mean, when I first was associated with FIP, it really was a business that focused primarily on international licensing and on international partnerships. The nature of international publishing has changed dramatically in the last 10 years. And as it's changed, so we've had to change as an organization. So really, those kind of formalized marketplace events are less effective now. And what is effective for publishers is networking in the broadest sense, because you can't tell anymore what somebody needs necessarily for their business. Each person's requirements are different. That means that a single standardized, homogenized marketplace event was not necessarily the right thing to do. The networking through the Congress is so powerful that it gives everybody the opportunity to find the person or the business that they need. The other thing that's changed dramatically in the time that I've been involved with FIP is the nature of media markets themselves. When I first started, there was definitely a way to publish a magazine, as it was then, in Germany or in the US and in the UK. And there wasn't a lot of learnings that you could take necessarily from one market to another. There were some, but not many. Now, the way that we do business is becoming standardized across the world. Everybody is trying to do the same things. We're all interacting with the same platforms and the same partners. And so the lessons that we learn are pretty universal and can be applied universally as well. So we might find an example of best practice in Nigeria or in Finland or in Turkey, and that would be applicable to a business in Canada or Argentina or even the US. So that's a kind of, you know, related point in the sense that the globalization of our industry means that the networking opportunities have become infinitely more complex and infinitely more varied, which is obviously really exciting for us.
And you've been attending the FIP Congress now in various roles for such a long time. Do you have any favorite memories of the Congress or anecdotes that you can share with our audience behind the scenes?
Behind the scenes, absolutely. Well, I do remember one of the first ones I went to was in Beijing, which was sometime in the middle 2000s, the early part of this century. And it was a fantastic spectacle. I mean, it was probably the last of the, let's say, old school congresses where, you know, Congress used to be treated like the Olympics. Countries would bid to bring the Congress to their country and treat it almost like a state occasion. And that was certainly the case in China. And I'll never forget that the concluding dinner for the Congress in China was in the Great Hall of the People in the middle of Beijing. You know, the fantastic building that they used to host the Party Congress and all that kind of stuff. And there we were sitting and watching you know, local dance, and we had speeches and all this kind of stuff. But I do remember that on every table there was a mysterious Chinese publisher on each table that we weren't entirely sure who they were. And we worked out afterwards that they were there to make sure that we behaved ourselves, and that as
and publishers
at the end of an event when we started to really enjoy ourselves, that we didn't embarrass this great room that was so important to them and that we were all in. So this poor chap had to sit through our dinner not understanding a word of what we were saying, watching us drink all his wine and eat all his food, and make sure that we were good. And of course we didn't disgrace ourselves in those
days. Of course. All right. So now you set the level for this year's Congress straight. What are your expectations for the event in Qashqai?
Well, I think we've said the word several times already. It's networking, I think, is really key for this year. We've had 3 years. The last Congress was in 2019 in Las Vegas, a very different time, a very different audience. So we've had 3 years since we had a Congress. We've had really 5 years since we've had a Congress in Europe. Mm. So I'm expecting that everybody is really excited and looking forward to seeing their friends and their colleagues and their business partners, both old and new, in person, which we've not done for so long. So really the emphasis this time is, of course, on having a fantastic conference program. We've got some really great speakers. I'll talk about that a bit later. We've allowed a lot of time for people to network with one another, and we're trying to bring in some ways in which they can do that formally and informally so that they get the chance to rebuild all of those connections. It's been great over the last few weeks and months in preparing for the Congress. I've actually been back traveling again, meeting people. I was in Portugal last week meeting companies and publishers there, and the level of engagement and the level of connection that you're able to have with somebody in person is 10 times what you get online, as
we all know.
And the opportunities that flow from that are so much greater.
And let's talk a little bit about the program that you're preparing just to convince really everybody to come and attend the Congress. Who's speaking?
Well, I'm delighted that we've got some really fantastic speakers. I mean, we're very lucky in that Cobus, who does all of our conference programming, has got such great connections around the world. It allows us to invite people, and they always say yes, to come and tell us what they're doing. And I'm delighted that this year the keynote is going to be from Arnaud de Puyfontaine, who, as many will know, is the CEO of Vivendi, one of the largest media groups in Europe. And he's going to tell us really about what their plans are for the future. And hopefully he's going to tell us as well about their recent investment in magazines. They bought a very large magazine media business in France, Prisma Media, a real kind of encouraging sign for those of us who work in the magazine media industry that there is still a lot of appetite for investment. We've also got Ralph Buchi, former FIP chairman, currently chairman of the supervisory board of Axel Springer, talking about the future of journalism. We've got the chief business officer from Dotdath Meredith in the States, Ailsa Borsa, who's going to talk about that new business and the exciting things that have happened since the merger between Dotdash and Meredith. And that's just on the first day. And then I could run through the list of names that are there. The details are all on the website, fipcongress.com. But we've tried to have the usual mix of different industry sectors, different perspectives on media, different regions as well, and different people from speaking from around the world. I'm delighted that we've got, for example, Nkiru Balonwus speaking from Nigeria, who sits on or has been an advisor to Netflix in Nigeria, giving us a perspective on African markets. We've got Srini from India talking about the fantastic things that they've done in the Indian market. So, you know, we don't just use the name World Media Congress lightly. We do take that seriously and try to present global perspectives and not just make it a US, UK, German affair. And I hope people will come and see that. And then, of course, one final thing to mention on the program is the launch of the annual FIP Innovation in World Media report. So we'll have Juan Senor and his colleague Inej Bravo from Innovation Consulting presenting the latest thoughts on innovation in our sector. And this really is one of the most useful sessions we do, in that it gives you techniques and ideas that you can take back and implement in your business immediately.
It's also my favorite session, the innovation in magazine media, and that's really entertaining, and I always take so much out of it. And talking about the different perspectives, you just mentioned Vivendi taking over Prisma from a German company, actually, from G&J, who sold it. What is your view on the German publishing industry? I know that you come to used to come to Germany on a regular basis for the Innovator Summit. What is your impression? How is the industry in Germany doing?
I mean, the industry in publishing industry in Germany has always been one of the most vibrant ones in the world. And I think it's encouraging to see that that still seems to be the case. I mean, of course, the print element of the industry has its challenges in Germany as it does in every other market. But I would say that over the last 10 or 15 years, it has ridden out those challenges much better than some other markets have done. You still have a very healthy newsstand presence in Germany, noticeably different from what you see, for example, in the UK or the US. You have a very diverse range of companies there. You've not consolidated down into one or two like has been the case in many other markets. And you have an exciting new association as well to look after you with the transformation of the VDZ into a new, genuinely national organization representing publishers. I think there's a lot to be encouraged about. And then if you look at the digital side of the business, I mean, the investments that German publishing companies are making into digital businesses is astonishing. You know, whether you think about Axel Springer's joint venture startup investment hub, private equity business, basically, venture capital business, making some fantastic deals. The same for Burda. So a real the thing that FIP is always talking about in its presentations to the industry is the need to diversify revenue. And you really see that German companies. And I think it's probably pretty easy when you're in the German market and immersed completely in that market to not have that perspective of realizing how well the market is going there. I mean, from the outside looking at it is one of the healthiest ones in the world.
Talking about digital, in a previous podcast, you said the model of digital advertising is broken. Can you please explain?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you can talk about that both at the, I can explain that both at the macro level and the micro level. I mean, the macro level is that on a like-for-like basis, given the audiences we get with digital advertising and the amount of effort we put into to securing those audiences and the response that we get from them, the return, the revenue that we get from digital advertising is nowhere near what we got from print. That's the kind of first level of it being broken. You know, it does not replace what was there before. Arguably, in aggregate, it is lower quality than print was, and yet the return seems to be much, much lower. I think the bigger point, though, is that the digital there's two kind of aspects to the second part. The first is that the chain that makes up digital advertising is rather obscure, let's say. If you think about the tech platforms and the tech value chain that's involved in digital advertising, there are so many different intermediaries that are involved that the amount of value that ends up coming back to a publisher is often very few cents on the dollar, or certainly, you know, much less than we would expect. Related to that as well, there is an enormous amount of fraud happening in the digital advertising space. So
fraud? What do you mean?
Well, there are, you know, clients are being defrauded out of their money. Not by us, I have to say, not by publishers.
Hopefully.
No, of course not. But publishers are affected by this. You know, you can find multiple instances of companies advertising onto platforms and into digital platforms that actually where the audiences don't exist. It was a great example a number of years ago where the FT, I think it was, went on to one of the programmatic exchanges and found that there was FT branded video advertising offered on a programmatic exchange when the FT themselves don't offer any video inventory programmatically. So somebody made a calculation of how much the industry was affected by digital ad fraud, and it's in the billions. So it's not a small problem at all. There are a number of initiatives going on at the moment, led primarily by the IAA, to try and have a sort of trusted chain so that advertisers can have trust in the end outlet for their advertising. But nevertheless, it's something that I think we don't take seriously enough, because never mind the fact that we don't get enough money from digital advertising, the money we do get is probably only 2/3 of what we could get if there wasn't so much fraud out there. And then the second aspect to this is the one that I like to talk about a lot, which is the kind of strategic point about if you're in digital advertising, what's the play? What do you hope to achieve? You're competing against Facebook and Google and Amazon, basically. And those three guys between them control something like 70 to 80% of the digital advertising market. So if you're playing in digital advertising, you're playing in the remaining, let's be generous and say it's 25%. And you're trying to be the biggest player in that space against every other business in the world. So your competition is not just your media competitors anymore. It's any other business anywhere that takes digital advertising, which might be an influencer. It might be just a brand that has a lot of traffic and decides to put ads on their site, whatever it happens to be. So I just find it strange that we're trying to be a market leader in something we can never be a market leader in. That's not classical business strategy.
If digital advertising is broken, then what would you say, what is going to make money?
I think the first thing to say there is that it's broken, but it's not broken to the extent that you should switch it off. It's merely broken to the point that you shouldn't rely on it as your primary source of revenue. Digital advertising should be one of five or six ways that you make money. And the recent crisis demonstrates this perfectly, right? Because if you had five or six different ways to make money during COVID, the chances are that three of them would have been severely affected negatively, but three of them might have been affected positively, and you'd have been in a good position. I think the key trend that we're seeing emerging at the moment is a focus on direct-to-consumer revenue. So it's removing the intermediary from your relationships. It's having a direct relationship with the people who consume your content, building an audience profile around them, and monetizing them primarily through a combination of digital subscriptions and e-commerce, or paid content and e-commerce. And there's a magical kind of thing that starts to happen when you build a community of engaged consumers, when you ask them to pay for additional content that plays to their passion, and then you ask them to transact with you based around your expertise, then you really start to make a lot of money. And that's, and by the way, you can do all of that and still monetize them through digital advertising as well. So that's the sort of magical combination that seems to be emerging that I think people really should be focusing on. The last thing to say on this, Christian, I think as well, is this is not me saying it, somebody else said this, but one of the favorite things I heard is that digital transformation is not about swapping reliance on print advertising for reliance on digital advertising. Genuine digital transformation is about diversification.
You just mentioned, I think, the major trend this year in publishing. Any other trends that you see?
Well, there's some interesting trends happening. I mean, of course, there are some let's say, societal trends that publishing has to be very aware of. The two, let's say, moral imperatives that we have to be conscious of are sustainability, which, you know, took a bit of a backseat during COVID, but is coming back into prominence now. And diversity, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement is having a dramatic effect on the way that companies recruit and retain staff, and is something that cannot be ignored. It is a moral imperative. It's an economic imperative as well. You know, we can prove that companies do better when they are more diverse. And related to that is another societal one about, you know, may have heard this term, the Great Resignation. Well, what's sitting behind the Great Resignation is a dramatic change in the way that people want to work and live. They want companies that have a workplace culture that is more flexible, that is more adaptable, that is more willing to change, that is more distributed in terms of power, that is more respectful, and that is also a bit more campaigning, that takes a view on issues. And these are all things that are important to, you know, the generations that are coming up to in the workforce at the moment, and they are the differentiator between getting the right talent and not. I was at this round table last week in Portugal and asked the question, what are your key business challenges? And of course, they said things like paper prices and all this other stuff. Time and again, talent, acquiring and retaining the right talent. It's very hard to get and keep good people.
As you know, I had Ralf Büchi from Axel Springer on one of the recent episodes here on the podcast, and he also mentioned that talent is really crucial for the success of the industry. But he also said that he sees an uprise in the quality of talent that's willing to work in media again. So I think we can be quite positive about this. And since this podcast is called We Like Max, I have to ask you, James, do you still read printed magazines? Or is it all just digital?
No, I do. I don't read any digital magazines, I have to say, with apologies to my digital magazine friends who may be listening. If I'm reading a magazine brand, I'm reading it in print. I mean, of course, I would do that anyway. I think printed magazines are still a fantastic way to spend your time, a fantastic way to engage with your passion. I have an enormous pile of them sitting over here in my room, and I'm regularly out there buying new magazines to try to find interesting new ways to approach this subject. And I think the encouraging thing for me is that for the last 15 years, 10 years, if you were a fan of print, you had to almost hide it. Because there was a little bit of embarrassment about being a fan of print. If you work in the industry, I mean, there was a danger that people thought you were old-fashioned. Print is coming back now into something that is, print is becoming cool again, basically. And we're seeing this incredible transformation of the print industry, which I think will accelerate in the next few years, and the repositioning of print as a luxury product, which is fantastic to see.
A lot of these launches in the last few years came from independent publishers, so rather smaller publications. Do you think that we will see big publishers also launching new print formats, and be it within a 360 degrees brand ecospace?
You might see that. I think what you'll see more of is you'll see established publishers transforming their existing brands into, certainly the print aspect of their existing brands, into the independent publishing model. And that is starting to happen. We're starting to see that with some brands already. If you think about the characteristics of an independent publishing model, you want high pagination, a lot of content, very high quality, both in terms of the content and the paper in production. You want a very high cover price, much higher than we're used to seeing. You want lower frequency, sort of six issues a year, coming out of the average 4 to 6 issues a year. And you want direct delivery, avoiding the newsstand. And you probably aren't that interested in advertising unless you happen to get some. So it's sort of transforming this the product into something that is an event. When a new issue of a magazine lands in somebody's home, comes through the door, that should be an anticipated, exciting moment for that consumer, where they know they've got a couple of months then to lean back and enjoy this fantastic experience. And that they're prepared to pay an appropriate price to do that. I mean, if we're honest as an industry, we have underpriced our products dramatically for far too long. If a magazine costs less than a bottle of wine, then you're undercharging for it because a magazine has more utility over a longer period than a bottle of wine does.
I never thought of it that way, but I think you are right. Perfect. James, thank you very much for all the insights. I'm really looking forward to seeing you again in Portugal in person. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you to everybody for listening. If anybody wants to know more, they can visit our website, which is fipp.com. Or if you want to contact me, you can do that. I'm just james@fipp.com. Always happy to hear from anybody who might have listened to this and wants to know more.
Und wenn Sie, liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, James Hughes live und in person in Portugal sehen wollen und vielleicht ein bisschen Schweizerdeutsch mit ihm plaudern wollen, dann gucken Sie doch auf der Webseite nach fipcongress.com. Da können Sie sich registrieren und können auch nochmal das Programm anschauen. Wirklich tolle Speaker dabei, und ich freue mich, wenn wir uns da sehen.